Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-5330, Muhammad S. Balouche, Appellant versus Dirk Kipthorne. Mr. Selden for the appellant, Ms. Fields for the appellee.
If it please the court, on the first and what is arguably the most important of the two claims that Mr. Balouche asserted, the removal of his substantive job duties, the government never moved for summary judgment. Never did, and that is, if my memory serves me, absent from its brief as appellee. The district court took over the role first as litigant, and then it took over the role of a jury. And finally, it took over the role, of course, as a matter of law in ruling against Mr. Balouche. The simple facts of this case, this claim, were uncontroverted. Mr. Balouche's job at BIA was divided into two areas, what's called water rights adjudication, which has to do with consent decrees with Native American tribes, and water resources management, which concerns the budgetary operations. That's what was in our opposition.
And doesn't the record show that he continued functioning in those areas even after the arrival of Mr. Picard?
No, it doesn't. It does not. And in fact, this is the problem. When there isn't a motion for summary judgment and a party moves for summary judgment the first time in the Court of Appeals, what was undisputed was that on day one, Mr. Picard took over half of Mr. Balouche's duties, which was in the water rights adjudication area.
And that's to be expected when you double your number of workers, right? This is something that they had long sought for. They said they were understaffed and wanted a new person. It seems unexceptional to me that you have another person and you have less work to do.
See, and this is the difficulty of moving for summary judgment before a circuit court. See, because what you've got is a whole record there, supposedly from the appellee, but you see, it's not the whole record. First of all, it begins with the argument, okay, that the division of job duties was unrebutted in the district court. Well, they didn't move for summary judgment, so we never had the opportunity to rebut it. And had we done so...
Where do you make these procedural claims in the brief? I understood the brief to be... a contention and the reply brief also, that the criteria, the basic legal, substantive legal criteria for grant of summary judgment were not satisfied.
Correct.
But now you're focusing on something that is new to me. Not saying it's not the case, but it just...
What we're talking about, and I can't find the page, is that summary judgment was never moved for by the district. It was never moved for by the government on the reassignment of Mr. Balouche's duties.
But
they never moved for summary judgment.
I am correct in thinking that your opening brief does not identify some procedural claim you're making now, that somehow or other the plaintiff was caught short. Deprived of an opportunity to put forward his position?
Well, I'm looking right in our statement of the issues, Roman numeral 1 on page 2, whether the district court erred in granting summary judgment against plaintiff on two factual grounds not advanced by defendant or identified in defendant's statement of material facts. That's the first issue that we have right there.
The argument heading is, erred in finding the reassignment of plaintiff duties and responsibilities did not constitute an adverse personnel action. That seems to be go straight into the merits.
No, the art. Well, I believe there's no dispute. I can't find the page, but there's no dispute that the government didn't move for summary judgment on this claim.
I mean, I guess as I look at the first paragraph of the summary judgment, of the summary of the argument, it's saying, it's quoting language appropriate only if there's no genuine issues to any material fact, so forth, usual substantive standards. I see down at the runover section, you introduced, you served it. Well, but that's the usual argument, again, that the district court resolved disputed issues of fact. And there's an argument about circular reasoning. I mean, I don't know, it seemed to me, as I say, just a conventional summary judgment issue. But I mean, is there some specific claim of a way in which you did not have an opportunity to call the judge's attention to some point in the record?
Yes, that is the point we're trying to make. And the point in response to Judge Griffith's question is, what were the changes? They're claiming it was an unrebutted reason for taking away Mr. Belush's duties. And the first set of duties that were taken away were in the area of water rights adjudication. Now, their claim is that
in the joint appendix at 370, he had meetings with attorneys in the solicitor's office and negotiated with parties to help resolve a water rights dispute. Joint appendix 175, he continued to work on budgetary analysis. Joint appendix 393, he worked on a position paper and met with the deputy secretary about water pump test issues. It doesn't sound like these things were completely taken away from him. No question, there's diminished workload, but that was the plan, right? They were needed to hire for it.
This is the problem when you move for summary judgment the first time in an appeals court. If you look, and I don't know that it's in the joint appendix, but it's in the record, the argument here is that Mr. Verdin, who was the senior most person at BIA, authorized Mr. Lohman, the person who the case focuses on, to take away Mr. Belush's duties. And it says first, page 83 of Mr. Verdin's deposition, did you have the intention that Mr. Belush would be removed from active engagement in the water rights adjudication and negotiation process or program in your office? And his answer is no. Now, the government is arguing for the first time on appeal that this was all set up by Mr. Verdin, and the idea was to take away Mr. Belush's duties, that came from Mr. Verdin. And yet he himself says that he did not have the intention to have Mr. Belush's duties taken away. And we have that discussed in the brief. And the idea that this was someone else's responsibility, other than Mr. Lohman, who the case focuses on, it's the problem when the first time that summary judgment comes up is on an appeal. What happens is,
let's assume it was an adverse action. Why wasn't it a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for the BIA to hire an additional person to better manage the work responsibilities? That's what they assert, backed up by evidence in the record, and it's your burden to show that legitimate non-discriminatory reason is a pretext for discrimination. Where's the evidence of that?
First of all, their argument once again is that the senior most super management official supposedly did this and took away Mr. Belush's duties, but in fact, in his own deposition, he said he did not. It then says that at some point, you know, his own memo.
I think we can assume necessarily when one person used to be doing everything and a second person comes in, some of the things that the first person used to be doing all by himself are now going to be done by both people or mm-hmm. or shared. That's common sense, right? But the question is whether the reasons for doing this, namely to better manage the workload and because they now had the budgetary ability to do it, are somehow discriminatory. And I don't see any place where you attempt to show in the reply brief, for example, that that was a discriminatory reason.
Well, we have.
Or a pretext for discrimination, I should say.
We have all of the disparate treatment, the differences in treatment by the supervisor who changed from the original plan, screaming at the plaintiff, treating him
differently. Okay, that's on the retaliation, I suppose.
No, I would think with all due respect, sir, that's evidence of discrimination, that he treated him differently from his from the colleague, Mr. Picard, who was hired, that he examined, that he claimed he was abusing his leave by going out of town or by using leave on weekends and around holidays when Picard...
One claim is the mere hiring of Mr. Picard was a pretext for discrimination to reduce the duties of the plaintiff, correct?
No, what we're saying is that Mr. Lohman engaged in, if you will, a bureaucratic fraud, that in fact it was not supposed to work out that way, and according to the senior manager, Mr. Verdon, and then Lohman manipulated this process, when in fact I believe the memo in the record from Mr. Verdon that they point to says, I don't think that your job is going to be changed, that at some point, you know, you will be assisted by Mr. Picard. But what happened is on day one, Picard took over his duties and half his job. And then by December of 2002, what you see in the record is the other half of the job in budgetary matters is also taken away. And Mr. Lohman is writing a memo.
But what's the evidence that that's was based on discrimination?
Well, once again, it is when you have, for example, under Holcomb versus Powell, okay, which is Judge Janice Rogers Brown opinion, you've got various different ways of contesting claim of discrimination circumstantially, and one is by showing a difference in what they said on day one and the way it works out. Mm-hmm. Okay, and on day one, it was not supposed to work any sort of change in Mr. Belushi's duties. And yet the minute, that's what the argument is by the government, in fact. It's not by the government, sorry, it's by the memo in the record. And yet on day one, half of his job is taken away. That's a clear credibility question that by circumstantially under Holcomb versus Powell allows a case to go to a jury for a person who meets a prima facie case. That allows it to go to the jury that he's lying about this, that supposedly Mr. Belushi's job is not going to change, and that it does change from day one. What happens is also under the Sokolsky decision, whether or not this is a change in jobs, and this is why we don't think it's right to remand this case and go through summary judgment a third time. The Sokolsky decision says very clearly whether or not a reassignment of duties is actionable, whether it's a material change in the terms and conditions of employment, is ordinarily a jury question. And what happened here is that Judge Urbina, even though there's no motion for summary judgment by the government, sifts through the record, seizes on a fact that's completely wrong, and then enters summary judgment against the plaintiff.
But that alone doesn't get you to trial. In other words, you can assume arguendo, as is true in most discrimination cases, that there was an adverse action. You can assume arguendo that there's an adverse action here. To get to trial, you still have to show that the legitimate non-discriminatory reason asserted by the defendant has been overcome by some evidence sufficient to create a jury question as to discrimination. And I just don't see that latter part in your discussed in your reply brief.
They never move for summary judgment. What they assert primarily, okay, is that this was a legitimate plan to divide up the duties that had previously been performed by one
person. So are you saying we are to infer racial improper animus on the fact that the supervisor said one thing would happen and another supervisor did something differently?
The command was that, yeah, the way this was set up was that it was from the larger supervisor, was right, that it was not supposed to affect Mr. Belushi's duties. And yet Picard testified and everybody agreed.
And out of that we're supposed to infer discriminatory intent?
Yes, out of that and the fact that he's screaming at him, that he's asking for medical records, that he's engaged in a lot of activities obviously designed, that he is never abusive, for example. Picard admitted this. Lohman has never been abusive to Picard, never yelled at him, never done anything to him at all. But here is an older man who has disabilities. He's blind in one eye. He needs medical attention. He's screaming at him. He is threatening to drag him out of the office in handcuffs. And he is not doing anything like this to the similarly situated co-worker. Not a thing. Nothing like this. The other guy's never been counseled. And here we have a man who's proposed to be suspended for 30 days because his voice mailbox is supposedly full. He's given unsatisfactory performance ratings, which is the beginning of removal proceedings in the federal government. Okay, he is doing all of these things. There is no other evidence, circumstantial, that anyone is required to have or probably could have of discrimination. Different treatment by a coworker, personnel actions that are unjustified, false statements justifying the taking away of his job. That's the essence. Not only is it the essence of a circumstantial case, it's a very powerful circumstantial case. I've been involved in many, many of these cases. That is a considerable body of evidence, far more than you need to go to trial. And here we have a case where the government didn't move for summary judgment. Judge Urbina seized on a fact that duties that were undisputed were corollary to Mr. Belushi's job because they're mentioned in a big cash award he got in 1998.
Your time has expired. Any questions from Judge Cavan or Judge Williams? Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Can I just... The first opinion starts out, this matter comes before the court on the defendant's motion for summary judgment. That's not true?
On the second set of claims, on the hostile work environment.
This is the opinion that appears at 464.
The 2005 opinion. The 2005 opinion. The first one.
Yes.
They never moved for summary judgment on the first tangible employment action. They didn't do it. They never moved for summary judgment on that. They filed a summary judgment motion. You could ask Ms. Fields, the assistant U.S. attorney. She'll stand up as soon as I've answered your question, Judge Williams. They did not move for summary judgment on the tangible employment claim of removal of duties. They never moved for summary judgment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court. Plaintiff has argued that the government never moved for summary judgment on the transfer of the job duties. However, we would refer the court to the government's summary judgment motion. That would be document 20 at page, R20 at page 37, and it specifically states at number 10, transfer of job duties. Plaintiff also asserts that the hire of Mr. Picard and the restructuring of job duties within the branch constitute discrimination. These allegations do not raise a prima facie case of discrimination based on race, religion, color, national origin, etc. This was definitely raised as an issue on summary judgment. Plaintiff also asserts that there is some evidence of discrimination because of an alleged difference between Mr. Verdin and Mr. Lohman. However, the court would look at the memorandum which was issued to Mr. Belushi in March of 2001. That's at JA 349. This is Mr. Verdin's response to Mr. Belushi's request that his job duties not be taken away. And in this response, Mr. Verdin indicates that he has had and been displeased with problems with the litigation and the budgetary functions. And he indicates that he has asked Mr. Lohman to look at these issues and to give him some requested changes. And then he closes by stating that he has directed Mr. Lohman, this is at JA 350, to hire a water rights specialist. He indicates that the individual will work closely with Mr. Belushi, but he further indicates that at the appropriate time, the new water rights specialist will assume some of your current duties, and he goes on to state that this will allow you to spend an adequate amount of time on those activities directly related to the expertise of a water specialist engineer. And when you look at the record concerning the duties that Mr. Baluch continued to do, they in fact related to the duties as a water rights specialist as an engineer, because he was working on the Ataturk pump test. He was working on the Zuni Salt Lake matter. And he continued to have duties relating to those, as well as duties relating to the budget, as the record reflects. There was no diminishment or taking away of all of his duties. There was no evidence that he had no substantive duties.
There was a diminishment of duties, though. Right?
There was a numerical diminishment of duties, but it was not necessarily a qualitative diminishment of responsibilities. Obviously, when you have one person who was running the whole organization and then the duties are divided among several people, there is a diminishment of the number of duties. But that is not evidence of discriminatory animus concerning the individual.
But it is evidence of an adverse action.
No, it's not. We don't believe so, Your Honor, because for there to be an adverse action, there has to be a showing that there was either a removal of supervisory duties or else a substantial diminishment of all duties.
Right, and you said there had been a diminishment of duties. Doesn't the jury get to determine whether it's substantial?
Well, the jury gets to determine whether or not it's substantial if the plaintiff has shown that Seskowski left the plaintiff with significant diminished responsibilities. Simply having a change of duties does not necessarily mean that your responsibilities are diminished.
Who decides whether it's significant or not? There's no question there's a diminishment in responsibilities, right? But as your point is, that always happens when you add employees to a work pool. But who decides whether it's a significant diminishment in responsibilities?
Well,
is that a legal determination or is that for the jury?
In the first instance, Your Honor, the plaintiff is required to present evidence of that. Of a significant diminishment of responsibilities. In this instance, Mr. Baluch claimed that there was a significant diminishment because he was left, in quotes, solely with the training program. And he told the district court that that was a significant diminishment because this is the only evidence he submitted to him, because it was not in his position description. And the court said that is not evidence that, assuming what you say is true, assuming that the only responsibilities you had were in training, the fact that it wasn't in your position description is not evidence that your duties were significantly diminished because you're just.
He himself had created the program after he came into his duties.
Precisely, precisely.
So you're saying that that's a determination for the judge to make?
The judge can make.
Whether it's significant or not?
No, whether or not he has submitted evidence, but whether or not you can even draw an inference from the evidence he has submitted. And he did not submit any evidence from which a reasonable jury could draw that inference.
Was Mr. Lohman ever disciplined for his behavior in this?
Mr. Lohman was given admonishments concerning his use of language, improper language, but there was no discipline concerning anything else, Your Honor.
And your point also is that even if it were an adverse action here, that the plaintiff hasn't put forth sufficient evidence to overcome the legitimate non-discriminatory reason that's been asserted?
That's correct, Your Honor. He has submitted no evidence to dispute the non-discriminatory reason because he has submitted no evidence that Mr. Verdon did not honestly believe that he needed a second water rights specialist, and he submitted no evidence concerning the validity of the concerns that they had concerning the budgetary justification process.
What about the contention that the screaming and so forth, the terrible behavior by Mr. Lohman was confined to Mr. Baluch. There were everyone else in the office was treated decently.
The record really does not bear that out, Your Honor. But
Mr. Lowman was rude to everybody. I mean, super rude to everybody. Or super rude to a lot of people.
Mr. Lowman had a problem, yes, with his keeping his temper. Yes, Your Honor. However, when you look at the incidents which are talked about and you count them up.
Is that in the record that it was with, that he had that problem with others, or is there just nothing in the record about his relationship with other employees? Or is there anything in the record to say he wasn't that way with Mr. Picard, for example?
Mr. Picard has indicated that he did not yell and scream at Mr. Picard. Mr. Picard indicated that he had used vulgar language with Mr. Picard. However, when you look at, however, there's no evidence that he was in the same sorts of situations with Mr. Picard that he was in with Mr. Belush, and that they were necessarily similarly situated concerning the yelling incidents. Moreover, when you look at the incidents,
is there record evidence that he yelled at other employees?
I believe so, because Mr. Verdon testified that he had to admonish Mr. Lowman concerning his yelling. Yes.
Independent of his yelling at, or in addition to his yelling at Mr. Belush.
Yes, I would have to find that. But there was a representative who spoke with Mr. Verdon. I can find that in reference if your honors would like to give it to you.
Didn't the district judge clearly err in dealing with the retaliation claims in pointing to Mr. Belush's continuing to raise complaints, while the standard, as the judge said, is this question of how these things would affect a reasonable person?
We conceded in our brief, Your Honor, that was in fact error. However, that was not the motivating or the major reason for the court granting the motion for summary judgment, and does not negate the findings that the plaintiff failed to meet his burden on each of the issues.
Basically, we have to find de novo that the standards for summary judgment were met.
That's correct, Your Honor. If you have no further questions, thank you.
Does Mr. Selden have any time? We'll give you 1 minute, Mr. Selden, to.
The government did not move for summary judgment that the withdrawal of Mr. Belush's substantive job duties about them at all. They referred to them elliptically in the hostile work environment claim, as to which Judge Urbina ruled whatever went on there didn't amount to a hostile work environment. You can look in their statement of material facts, which is included in the joint appendix as our statement of genuine issues, because what we did is we retyped the material facts, and it begins on joint appendix 202, and you can see in there, okay, that when Mr. Belush stated in his declaration that the only duties he was left with were training duties, they were corollary. There was no dispute about it by the government. Now, the government is saying that's too conclusory a statement, but they never put it at issue below, and so it's impossible to refute it with any greater specificity. They never put it at issue, okay? Picard himself testified he had never been abused by Mr. Lowman. He'd never been under leave restrictions, okay, even though he himself had used his leave before and after weekends. You've got an email in the record of December 10th, 2002, in which Picard left and didn't complete his duties as water and budgetary matters, and yet he was never disciplined. You've got a.
Your time's
thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.